With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
This is your captain speaking. We've got clear runway and the weather's fine, but we're just going to circle up here a while and get lucky. No, no, nothing like that. It's just these cash prizes add up quick. So I suggest you sit back, keep your tray table upright, and start getting lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus terms and conditions apply. See website for details. With Lucky Land Slots, you can get lucky just about anywhere.
Dearly beloved, we are gathered here today to... Has anyone seen the bride and groom?
Sorry, sorry, we're here. We were getting lucky in the limo and we lost track of time.
No, Lucky Land Casino, with cash prizes that add up quicker than a guest registry.
In that case, I pronounce you lucky.
Play for free at LuckyLandSlots.com. Daily bonuses are waiting. No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
Okay, we're live. Hi, this is William Ramsey. Welcome to William Ramsey Investigates. On today's show, I have a very special guest from comes to us from Belfast in Ireland. His name is Chris Donaldson. Published a book in 2020 about his adventures traveling the world on a motorcycle. Title of the book, the long title, is Going the Wrong Way, a coming-of-age story like no other. Chris escapes 1970s Belfast on his Moto Guzzi Le Mans to find himself in the road to Australia. What could possibly go wrong? And there is an audiobook right now for Going the Wrong Way. Currently on Amazon in the U.S., it has 556 five-star reviews. And it really just talks about his really kind of a solo journey through the world on his motorcycle. Really fascinating. A lot of stories and vignettes of conflicts and countries and things that probably weren't very familiar to him in Ireland, but he can talk more about that. So Chris Donaldson, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
For people who may not have heard of you or your book, can you kind of talk about your background in Ireland and what led you on this kind of world journey?
Yeah, I was brought up in Belfast in the 70s. I went to secondary school in the middle of town, in the middle of the city, and I really didn't know anything else but what was going on in Belfast in the 60s and 70s. It was quite an unusual, now looking back, I can see it was quite an unusual place to live in the middle of basically a war zone. I was quite horrified when I took my daughter to the museum recently, actually, to notice that my life was in the history of Belfast was in the museum already. So I wasn't expecting that in my lifetime. But it was a peculiar place with bombs going off and the troubles as they were through the 70s and 80s. And there was a big, feeling in the kids when we were leaving school to get out of town, to get out of Ireland, to go to America, to go to England, wherever, just to get to go away. So there was quite a feeling. Ireland's always had a reputation for emigrating, but it was certainly very strong in those days.
For Americans may not be familiar with the troubles, can you talk about the background of kind of the conflict between the Catholics and the Protestants and what went on during that time? I mean, it was super chaotic, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's been Northern Ireland's been around for 100 years. It used to be Ireland was one country, and then this 100 years ago split up the north from the south, and it's never really been peaceful since. There's a Protestant majority and it's about a 60-40 split between the Protestants and the Catholics. Traditionally, the Catholic population would want to be part of Ireland, and the Protestants would want to be part of the UK. And there's been a simmering tension ever since. It was a 100 years anniversary this year. But in the 60s, it exploded. At the end of the 60s, there was civil rights marches turned to violence. And it spilled over the major cities in Belfast and Derry. It was pretty much a terrorist war with the city would be blacked out. Not blacked out, but after people went to work, everybody would go home and lock themselves in their own sort of suburbs. Nobody would come into town. So it was your typical guerrilla warfare going on. The British put soldiers into town to try and keep the peace, and they soon got caught up in a conflict on the Protestant side, effectively, and it was chaos for many years. until really the end of the 90s, the Good Friday Agreements resolved most of the issues.
Right. So there were tons of bombings. Thousands of people were killed, children, indiscriminate type of things.
Yeah, indiscriminate people. One of the problems was a lot of schools in the Northern Ireland are either a Protestant school or a Catholic school. So you're, you know, when you're a kid, you don't really care about the politics, but what you do care about is getting home from school without getting beat up. So you're pretty much, you had a flag on your back. So that's what your school uniform was, is what school you went to. So that was a sort of tension every day. I was lucky, we lived in one of the safer sides of town. But my parents had a family business, a furniture shop in the middle of town, which got blown up regularly. Our school was right in the middle of things as well, so we would have got our windows put in the odd time. So it was quite a hair-raising place to grow up, I suppose, looking back.
Right, so it was very chaotic. Was that probably how the seeds of your desire to kind of travel began, was trying to get away from all the violence?
I think so. I think I sort of saw, when I was in my teenage years, I saw the futility of it all. It was people arguing about very little, but people dying over very little, what I could see to be very little anyway. So I wanted to get away and see what happened in the rest of the world. Surely it couldn't be as bad.
Right. So you started on this collecting money, getting money together for your trip to Australia, right? Can you talk about how you kind of got ready for your journey?
Yeah. I'd always been into motorcycles, and I had a sports motorcycle called Motegi Le Mans, which I thought was the hottest bike in town. And at that time, I was 17, 18 years old. But I wanted to take something more sort of touring mode for like a BMW for the trip. But with one thing now, I never quite got around to getting that. I didn't have enough money to buy it. So I saved up working Saturdays, so on, to get enough money to head off. And I finally managed to get away in 1979, October 1979. Left Belfast, went to London, and started collecting my visas and so on to get to Australia. And as soon as I got to London, of course, 4th of November, I think it was, the Iranian Revolution kicked off and the American embassy was taken over, which basically sealed the route east to go to Australia. So that was my first, hence the name of the book, Going the Wrong Way, because I'd spent the last 2 years meticulously planning to where all the countries going to go through, getting the visas for them, the route I was going to pass through to get to Australia. And all of a sudden, it was just started, and effectively the road was blocked.
Right. So you were going to go from London, going straight east, all the way through the Middle East, the Asian countries, India, and that was your original route to Australia, correct?
Yeah.
And so you had to kind of change. So you were committed to going on the journey, but not that route, right? So
I was committed to going away. I didn't want to go back home. It would have been, you know, too embarrassing to sort of tell all your friends you're going to Australia, and then 2 weeks later come back home and say, "Oh, so we certainly couldn't make it." So I was determined to go summer. In those days, you couldn't get the Iron Curtain was up. You couldn't go to Russia. So the only choice I had was to go south. And I suppose what made the book was the fact that I hadn't a clue about Africa, about anywhere else, but where I was going to go. So I was totally heading into the unknown, which is quite hard to imagine these days with the internet and everything's being online and information so readily available. If you don't know anything about a country, just Google it. But in those days, of course, there's plenty of travel books around, but all the books that I had were for the wrong place in the wrong direction.
Right, so, and you had no cell phone, so you have no electronics, the things we take for granted, you didn't have, right?
Pretty much, his speedometer was the only thing I had to go on, you know?
Right. And so you really were flying free. I mean, you write in the book, like, you're sleeping where you can, you're meeting with people, you're going through zones that are conflict, right? Israel, Sudan. Can you kind of talk what it was like to be going from Greece to Israel and then traveling around the Middle East?
Yeah, we went down to Greece and I met up with a Scottish guy on a motorbike, and the two of us went over to Israel, thinking we could have gone from Israel to Egypt, which when you look at your map, it looked as if you could do that quite easily. And there'd been a ceasefire agreement with Israel at that stage a few months previously. But unfortunately, by the time we got there, we were too early. And it was quite peculiar. We were able to drive up to the front line, effectively, of the trenches and across the roads. You could see the Egyptian flag on the other side of the other side of the crossroads, and they wouldn't let us over. We had to go back around through Syria and Jordan to get back to where we were. So it's about 1,000 miles round trip to get the other side of the fence to get into Israel. Syria was fairly, these countries, the trouble you have in them now, it's been going on. This region's been in trouble for years and years. Conflicts go back to traditional religions and cultures. So, you know, what happens in Syria now hasn't changed for generations. So it's a similar place to be in 40 years ago as it is now, which is a bit scary when you're 21 and on your own.
Right. Like you're pretty young at that time, kind of trying to make your way, I mean, through all these conflict-laden regions, right?
Yeah.
And so what was Syria like back then in the latest 70s, early 80s?
Well, remember, one of the most peculiar things is they wouldn't let me out of the port. There was basically a war going on outside the port, but they wouldn't let me out without a spare tire, which I thought was a bit silly at the time. But actually, very often you put places like that, you go to, people are very friendly. They're pleased to see strangers coming in. They're very hospitable. It's just the region itself that, and the politics that makes it difficult. But the people you meet on the ground are usually quite friendly and very easy, nice to get on with.
Right. So you're finding most of the people are warm. Like you had warm experiences in Austria, kind of all through your travels, even into America, the Americas, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think traveling in a motorcycle.
For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com. For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com. For nearly four decades, JMK Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started JMK Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. JMK Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
People have an emotion about motorcycles. They either love them or hate them. Generally, people like them. There's something about them that they like. The fact that you're on your own as well, I think people are much more inclined to look after somebody on their own, to talk to them or help them along the way, rather than just crowded guys. So being on your own is by far the best way to see a country, to meet people and to get on.
Right. It works both ways, though, right? Because you're alone, too. So you're more amenable or available to talk with other people as well. So somebody you're with.
Yeah, you, you sort of have to talk to somebody. You can't just sort of go to a bar and talk to your mate. You have to talk to somebody. When you're on a motorbike, there's nothing between you and the outside. You know, it's not just sitting in a car with a window between people. You're in a box. When you're on a motorbike, you stop the side of the road. You're there. You're with people. So you're much more approachable for people as well.
Right. And so you're in this kind of crazy era of conflict. What was it like going from the Middle East to Egypt? And then you talk about going through the Nubian Desert, Sudanese, as a Westerner, right? A European.
Yeah. Egypt was chaotic, and I've been there recently. It's still chaotic. The traffic, I think, one of the worst things about the traffic in Egypt is they turn their lights off at night so they don't waste the battery. It's not great when you're driving down a two-lane highway. But I followed the road down past it, slept in the pyramids at Christmas Day before the tourism really kicked off, I suppose, as much as it would be there now. So you're, again, being on your own, you're not tied to tourist times. You can see things much more back to basics. But the further south I went, the more wild and natural things were, more back to nature things were. And in Sudan, the road actually stopped. There's no road across the desert at all. On my map, there's a road marked, but a road in Sudan is basically a direction you go to travel. Wow. It doesn't actually have any context of what the surface is, you know?
Wow. So you were really going back into almost primeval or primitive civilization, right?
Yeah, and I was on a motorbike at that stage, which was totally suitable for driving on roads and so on, but when you're driving off-road, it's completely different style of motorcycling. The motorbikes these days much more, I mean, it's the whole concept of enduro motorcycling cycles are designed for that sort of travel. In those days, you just took what you had and had a motor guzzy. Some days we would do 10 miles, drive all day, digging, pushing, then you'd cover 10 miles. So time and distance have a different meaning. Compared to traveling down freeways and motorways.
Right. And you literally had to contend with illness, hunger, thirst, right?
Yeah. I mean, South Sudan at that stage was heading into a famine. There's a war. Well, Central Africa is just one war after the other. So it's quite distressing to see the refugees and literally people's starving and dying of thirst, which is affecting us too, because although I didn't have a lot of money, you know, enough money to buy some food, which is what most people didn't have. So it certainly brought you back to down to earth of how well we are off in the West. I don't, when people say they're going hungry, they're hungry, they're not really hungry. You know, if you haven't eaten for days, you're starving, you know what hunger is. So I think Sudan was probably the hardest country I went through, and learned a lot of life lessons at that, you know, going through there.
Did you see anybody from the West? I mean, they were all different, just locals, right?
Just basically locals. Yeah, you know, occasionally you would have a Westerner traveler, but Sudan was off the beaten track because it's not like Egypt. There's lots of things to see there. Mm-hmm. You're traveling from one place to the other, so it's not really a popular tourist route. But no, you'd go for days without seeing any Westerners at all. At one stage, I couldn't find any petrol. I had to scrounge petrol off people, which is it's wild when you consider that sitting on top of billions of gallons of oil. Now it's a major oil producing country, but in those days it didn't have any oil at all.
And you literally saw lepers and, you know, people with diseases that
basically, yeah, you're back to, you're going through the jungle, people are running along beside you with bows and arrows and on spears in those days. So it was back going back thousands of years. Then I got to the south of Sudan. At that stage, Idi Amin had just left Uganda, so it wasn't much better. It was, drove into town. There was tanks, burnt down tanks to the side of the road, burnt down armored cars in the places under curfew at night. So I was really going out of the frying pan and into the fire, going from Sudan to Uganda.
Right, and that was the time when Idi Amin was running the country, right?
Yeah, he'd just been kicked out. Tanzania, their next door neighbor, had just kicked him out. There'd been a short war between them. So the Tanzanian army were running the place at that stage. But it was chaotic and lawless. I ended up, most of the hotels were shut. I ended up sleeping in the police station, central police station in town, for a couple of nights because all the police had disappeared as well. So it was... Africa was a little wild and unruly, to say the least.
Mm-hmm. So Uganda, you went through, what was the main city there? It was Kampala, right?
Yeah.
Kampala, right. So you went through Kenya at that time. I mean, these are like post-colonial countries too, so they're really going through a lot of different changes, right?
Yeah, Africa settled down a lot now, but in that stage, that time, it was a lot of corruption. Post-colonial, they're trying to work out the systems, their politics and their systems, and a lot of corruption, a lot of people trying to get
bribery, things like that.
Bribery, sure. Corruption, yeah. Kenya was okay, but Tanzania, Zambia again, the police, very often the police wouldn't get paid. The money wouldn't circulate down to them, so they were relying on bribes and fines and so on for their wages themselves, you know. So now, as if the bribes were lining their pockets, they didn't get paid. So the infrastructure of the country, the systems, the civil service just didn't exist in all these places.
Right. So it's difficult. You're always kind of, it's almost like you're a road warrior trying to find resources, right? Food, gas. Things like that, you know.
Well, it was a bit like that. Yeah, I mean, at one stage, coming up out of Sudan, I actually wrote off the edge of my map because I didn't have a map that went further south from that. So I literally didn't know what I was going to meet up with next. And as I say, I hadn't been able to do any homework to find out. So, but looking back on it, that's what made the trip, was the fact that usually when you go traveling, you're going from one place to the other. There's a destination in mind. Which I set off with the destination, my trip as well, was Australia. But after I got started, I really didn't have a destination. It was really just traveling for the sake of traveling. So it was quite a pure sort of way of life rather than actually going somewhere.
Right. And you had to kind of adapt to your environment too. Right. So you had to adapt to the country and nation you were in.
Since J&K Security Solutions opened in 1987, our attention to detail and customer service have been our strongest assets. I'm President Jeffrey Beckman. We'll always do our best to find the most efficient and cost-effective solution to every job we tackle. Whether it's security for your home or business, installing video surveillance, or being able to control your garage doors from your phone, we can help you feel empowered with simple and user-friendly technology. Let's work together to secure your home or business. JKSecurity.com.
Right.
Yeah, and that can vary, as you say, when you're traveling geographically from Sudan to from Austria to Sudan. You go from highs and lows, temperature wise and height wise. In Israel, around the Dead Sea, is 1,200 feet below sea level. You know, so it's quite extreme, and geographically and culturally as well. Finally, got down to South Africa in the middle of apartheid in those days, so it was an unusual system as well going on there.
And what were your memories about being in South Africa and Zimbabwe, right? It was Rhodesia, right? When you were there, it wasn't Zimbabwe yet, right?
Yeah, it was Zimbabwe, Rhodesia. It was just in the transition. Their war just stopped and they were transitioning to Zimbabwe. So I mean, whenever I left, they were having a war. They couldn't believe it got there because when I left, they wouldn't have been allowed to go there. So it was struggling that the borders were open at all. So it was a bit scary. Everybody was still traveling by convoys from one town to the next. It was still quite lawless going on there. But I guess, as you say, it's the end of the colonial rule was working its way through the whole of Africa. And the chaos revolved from that. But as far as I was concerned, South Africa was a civilized destination for me to go to. And it was certainly well received when I got there because they were cut off pretty much with sanctions and so on from the rest of the Western world. So wasn't very many people driving down or getting there at all in those days. So if you're an unusual tourist, you attract some attention, certainly. Beautiful country, nice people, friendly people, but again, with their own problems.
Right. So just like you're going from one conflict to another conflict to another conflict. When you got down to South Africa, you had to make a decision, right, about where to go next.
Well, I got to Cape Town. It's pretty much a dead end. It's not much further there than the South Pole. So it looked like I was going to have to sell the bag and just come home. I didn't have enough money to get to Australia. But luckily, that luck has an awful lot to do with traveling on your own. Or good luck or bad luck, being in the right place at the wrong place at the right time. I managed to get a job on a sailing yacht coming back to the UK, which was sponsored by a shipping company. So they shipped the bike to Los Angeles, and I got back to the UK, spent 5 weeks sailing in a yacht race back to the UK. I mean, the Volvo Ocean Race is a famous one that goes around the world every 3 or 4 years now. People train for years to get a place in the boat, one of those boats. Mm. Whereas I was just lucky enough to walk on and lucky I'd done a bit of dinghy sailing. My only sailing I'd done was a bit of dinghy sailing at that time. So it was from a solo motorcycle to being part of a crew in a yacht race. Couldn't be much more different.
Right. So you got on this boat, and how did you make it from there to North America?
Well, we'll go back to UK. Go back to UK after a few adventures in the boat, such as the rudder breaking off and having to stop and not get shipwrecked, but we managed to get into the Cape Verde Islands and get that fixed. Go back to the UK and then flew to Los Angeles to pick up the bike, which had just arrived into the port there. So I spent the next 6 months traveling around North America, going up to Canada, across to Ottawa, and then worked in North Carolina for some time and getting a bit of the American lifestyle, which I really enjoyed. I worked for people in North Carolina who I'm still in touch with, still do some business with. So amazing, after 40 years, still connections made when I was 21 are still alive, you know.
Interesting. All right, you were done with your journey, and you were still very young, 23, 20. So you did it right as a pretty young person, right?
Yeah, I didn't quite realize how young I was at that stage because, found out the other day, I think the youngest person to ride a motorbike around the world did the last year is 22, 23. So I was younger certainly than anybody I've met along the way. And then when I went down to South America, that's when everything started going wrong, I suppose. I got ill. I didn't have enough money to complete the trip the way I wanted to. And the bike was, I'd taken a hammering as well. So everything was starting to peter out, I suppose.
Right. And you have tons of pictures in the book, too, as well, of all your kind of adventures and people you met, too, right?
Yeah. Took a lot of photographs along the way. And, took a lot of notes. I was going to write a book about my adventures along the way. I started to do it at that time when I got back. And then I found out a guy, nobody had ever written a book. We were riding around the world before, but as soon as I got back, somebody had been at it before me, and he brought a book out, which is quite successful. So I decided he's done it. He's published a book. There's no point in me doing it. So it was hence the delay in 40 years from actually doing the trip to writing the book, which now looking back now, I can see it as a blessing, because when I was 21, I didn't really appreciate all the things that had happened to me, but I didn't appreciate how they would affect me psychologically, and looking how the impact it would make on how I lived my life, and the impact it made on me as a 21-year-old at that stage, you know. So I think I was able to write a much better book with the experience of not old age, but experience of the life experiences in between.
Right. I mean, and you were also inspired, I think you said, like, by the Long Way film with you and McGregor. They kind of did something like you, but yours was much more underproduced, so to speak.
Yeah. Well, I mean, to ride a motorbike the way through those countries that they did and we did is difficult enough, but there's a big difference doing it between doing it on your own or having a backup crew with trucks and spare bikes and so on as well. So not to don't talk what they've achieved by doing what they've done. But part of the reason you do a trip like that, I think, is to discover, it sounds a bit of a cliche, but to discover yourself, to see how you can react to different experiences, different cultures, and to test yourself. Whereas if you're with a crowd of people looking after you, you can't do that. So I do think they miss out a lot by the way they've done that. But if you're a film star and you got enough money to do that, that's the way you're going to travel.
You kind of had a little bit of psychological PTSD, you said, after you were done, right? Because you had pretty much been out for a year and a half or 2 years, you know, hard scrabbling your journey across the world, right?
Yeah. Well, I think if you're in a difficult situation, every day you're getting up, you don't know what's going to happen. For long enough, it's going to have an effect on you psychologically as well, because your brain goes into a system of coping with the unknown and the danger. And then when you're removed from that dangerous situation every day, it takes a while for your brain to adjust again. So you don't have to worry about where you're sleeping, what are you going to survive in the road, what you're going to do. You're always looking out for your back, see if there's anybody. When you're traveling a third world country, you're a rich guy. You've got a motorcycle. You've got possessions which people are envious of. You always got to be looking out for yourself. Right. But one of the recent things that's happened is that after I brought the book out, I still haven't never driven a motorbike to Australia, and I still have the same motorbike. So a friend talked me into.
For nearly four decades, J&K Security Solutions has provided protection for homes and businesses. I know firsthand. I'm Jeff Beckman, and with my wife, Kim, we started J&K Security Solutions. Our attention to detail, service after the sale, and product knowledge are the foundation of our success. J&K Security has routinely been recognized as the best of Madison for security companies. We expect that trend to continue as the next generation, our son Jeffrey, takes over as president. Let us protect what is valuable to you. JKSecurity.com.
Trying to make the trip again. So last year we set off on the same motorbike to go to Australia, only this time in stages, because we've got a wife and family and work to come back to. So it took 2 weeks to get to Israel again, didn't get out of Israel, but they wouldn't let me over the border again. So it was thought this is going all wrong. But I managed to get to Iran, Turkey and Iran, and the bike is now in Dubai. So in 2 weeks' time, I'm going to be going out to continue the trip that I started 42 years ago.
Oh, great. Awesome. And you were in Dubai for 8 years or something like that as well. So you've kind of kept that.
Yeah, I was home for a while, and lived in a yacht in Dubai. Every once in a while, all of a sudden, I find the experiences that I had on our journey have been useful as we go on.
Right, and you likened it, your experience, to kind of the Australian Aboriginal walkabout, right?
Yeah, I mean, looking back, I can see that it was certainly going back to the story, we're talking about getting out of Ireland, getting out of Belfast, getting away from your parents, getting away from your friends. I think your environment, your friends, your family has an impact on you. When you're young, you don't know what you're like without that. So it's only by removing yourself from all those influences that you can actually find your own personality.
Right. And this book has been very successful. I mean, you said you were prevented in writing it when you were younger, but right now it has 556 five-star reviews. It's only been out for 2 years, right?
Yeah, I think the fact that I'm not a sort of standardized writer, it can either be very, very good or very, very bad if you're a terrible writer. But it seemed to have struck a chord with a lot of people who have enjoyed reading it and have been able to look back on their own youth and their own lives through it. I think certainly a lot of motorcyclists, but a lot of non-motorcyclists as well, because everybody grows up at some stage, you know.
Right, but it's kind of like the tone that comes across is your stories are so interesting, layered upon on one after another, and you're talking to so many different people too. So it has a very human kind of interpersonal narrative to it. So I think that might be one of the reasons why they resonated with people. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I mean, I was saying earlier about traveling on your own. You say you're not staying in hotels very often. Very often you'd be staying with people, and you're driving into their houses, meeting their families, and you're able to see how their culture, how their family works, hear what their problems are. People talk to you as if you're a priest of some sort. You know that you're there. You're part of the family for a few days, but you're going to disappear again. So they're not worried about telling you their secrets. So you can get quite close to people quite quickly. It's an unusual way of traveling, which you don't get normally with as a tourist.
Right. So yeah, you are the off-roads tourist for sure. there's a lot of stuff we didn't get into, traveling through the United States, South America, Central America. I mean, you really covered some real territory. You figured out how many miles you traveled, right?
Yeah, probably did about 35,000. Oh, no.
It was almost, you circumnavigated the globe and then some.
Well, you actually can't ride around the world anyway, because there's too much water in between and a lot of politics going on there too, as I discovered. But what you can do is you go up and down, and the way the continents are organized, you see much more going up and down. The way I did it, you cover much more, see a lot more cultures and countryside than riding around the world anyway.
Right. And yeah, we're like at 35 minutes. Where's the best place for people to get the book? I assume that there's a UK version, or there's definitely a US version.
It's on Amazon in the US and in the UK all around. It's on paperback, hardback, and there's an ebook, and a Kindle book, and an audiobook as well. And I can deliver from my own website as well.
What's your website?
It's chrisdonaldson.world.
Chrisdonaldson.world, right?
World, yeah. So deliver anywhere.
So I'll put that in the show notes. Chrisdonaldson.world. And who did you narrate the audiobook?
No, I got my a nephew who's a bit of a rock star, or budding rock star. He's 21. I thought it would be slightly wrong for a 60-something-year-old to be talking about what a 21-year-old does in a way that's not just condescending or looking back. Somebody, I tried to write the book as if I was 21. by using my notes that I had that I'd written when I was 21. So I wanted the audio to be to reflect the same thing. So that's getting some very good reviews as well.
Yeah, it has excellent reviews. So just in the US, I have to go look at the UK. Is there anything you'd like to add, Chris, or anything I missed before we wrap up the discussion about your book Going the Wrong Way?
No, just to talk about reviews. I got a lovely review the other day. There's a guy whose son was in hospital for getting some back surgery. And he said he was able to read the son couldn't get a set up in bed to read, but he read the book to him. And he actually sent me a review to say how well and much they both enjoyed it. And it really helped him to look ahead and get better. So it's quite touching to get some reviews like that. But reviews are great for authors to bump up their confidence, but also it's good for readers obviously to see if it's a good book or not. But it's one of the nicest reviews I've had, certainly.
Oh, good. And it's really it is an adventure book. It really is kind of like a modern adventure book, going through strange places and peoples and climates and territories and stuff like that.
Yeah, I did some very silly things.
Things you wouldn't do at your
age. Things you wouldn't do that.
Yeah, I mean, going through the Nubian desert in Sudan without any roads on a motorcycle.
Yeah.
Pretty daring. Anyway, thanks so much for your time, Chris Donaldson. Again, the title of the book, the full title, is Going the Wrong Way, a coming-of-age story like no other. Chris escapes 1970s Belfast on his Moto Guzzi Le Mans to find himself in the road to Australia. What could possibly go wrong? And it's published July 2020. You can get it online, and I will put your website as well on there, chrisdonaldson.world, and people can contact you there if they want to reach out to you, right?
Great, yeah.
Okay, great. Thanks so much for your time, Chris.
Thanks very much, Adam.
All right, stay there. You're welcome. Stay there.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.